Hello, and welcome to episode 260 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
There seems to be no shortage of things people feel guilty about. We feel guilty about working too much and not working enough. We feel guilty about what we eat, how we spend our money, whether we exercise enough, and whether we're spending enough time with the people we care about. Parents feel guilty about their children, adult children feel guilty about their parents, and sometimes we even feel guilty about taking a vacation or simply doing nothing at all. Derek Thompson recently wrote about research suggesting that Western culture has become increasingly focused on personal happiness, pleasure, and freedom from restraint. At the same time, he wondered if modern people might also be especially prone to guilt. When I shared that article with you, you had an interesting response. You said you weren't convinced we necessarily feel more guilt than people did in the past. Instead, you suggested that guilt has become what you called free-floating, because our culture has lost much of the shared moral framework that once told people what they should and shouldn't feel guilty about. So, Rick, I think I'll start with maybe the broad question here. What is guilt actually good for?
Guilt has a function within a culture that has some shared understanding. I would say shared metaphysics, a shared understanding of the nature of reality, in which, like, our lives are good if they conform to the way the world really is, and they are not good if they don't conform to that. And so then guilt is for getting us back into conformity with the way we ought to live. Once we have no shared agreement on how we ought to live, then guilt becomes what I call free-floating, becomes untied to anything, but it becomes a remnant. It's just this negative feeling of blame that we carry around with us, and there's no way to get rid of it.
So it sounds like guilt can be a bad feeling, but it can also, when applied properly, be morally useful?
Well, yeah. So, like, my kids, for example, when they were little, if one of my two kids, if one of them hits his brother, for example.
Which would never happen in your household, but hypothetically.
It certainly did happen. And I would want to make sure that the kid who did the hitting felt guilty about it, because then they would have to change their behavior. And so, like I'd want them to feel sorry about it, and then they would have to do something in order to get rid of that feeling of feeling bad. They would have to do something. That is, they would have to go and apologize. Now, and this is the key thing. Like, the way you get rid of guilt in a traditional society where we have some kind of shared moral framework is there's what's called a moral economy. There's some exchange that takes place, and so, like in the Catholic Church for a long time, you feel guilty because you broke one of God's laws. You'd go to confession and you'd say, "Father, I've sinned," and then you'd receive forgiveness. But also then something like, what do you do in penance, right? Because there's an exchange. So, and this, as I was mentioning, this can happen in families too, or like it can happen among friends. So, like, if I've done something to you, like I've lied or I've betrayed you somehow or something, like, I go to apologize and I say, like, what can I do to make this up, right? And there's can be an exchange, and then if that exchange works out, then there's forgiveness, and say, okay, let's start again. This is the basis in which any fully functioning society works. It's something Hannah Arendt says, like, any community works on the basis of promising and forgiving. So promising, we create expectations, understanding what do we do for one another. And forgiving, we have to do that because we always break our promises. So what do we do when we break the promises? Well, we have to reestablish the relationship.
when I was thinking about this, I was also thinking of maybe an overlapping thing called judgment. And it reminded me of, I think it was an ethical dilemma conversation we had like a couple of years ago. But I'll bring it up briefly now because I think it kind of gets at this. How I remember asking the question was, let's say you're sitting out on a nice summer day on your front porch with an 8-year-old kid. It might be yours or relative of some sort that you have a connection with. And driving past down the street on a bicycle appears to be a 50-year-old man with a beard and just looks like, you know, a regular guy, except he's wearing a pink dress. And, you know, the 8-year-old starts giggling or sort of like making fun of this man who's wearing a dress. And I think the response was, and I think a lot of people have come to the realization that if that person wants to drive or ride around on a bicycle in a pink dress is not really bothering anybody. And maybe there's a lesson learned there with this kid about saying, you know, we shouldn't judge people for doing things like that because they're not harming anyone. You know, we don't know what's causing that man to wear a pink dress and drive around on a bicycle, but that's fine. And I think generally that's like a good thing. But I think we also, though, kind of using the slippery slope analogy, have gotten to be so uncomfortable with judging others that there are things, and I think you're exactly right, where societies as complex as ours need to have some sort of order around them. And obviously, a man riding around on a bicycle with a pink dress doesn't really do anything to harm the societal order of things. But when we do see people doing things out in public that are harmful, whether it's, you know, being very disruptive, whether it's being kind of minor law breaking with shoplifting and things, I think there's a part of society that feels like, well, no, we shouldn't judge those things. We shouldn't make people feel guilty about that because maybe that person stole the ham sandwich from the deli because that was the only way they could get food that day. Who knows, right? And so I think we have that stacked on top of it. And I guess I just wonder if you buy into my argument that there are times that a well-functioning society does sometimes need to judge the behavior of others, not obviously saying like killing people is bad, but like just people's behaviors that are sort of make our society less ordered and less pleasant is bad. And I guess one thing I'll stack on top of that is, and then I'll let you respond as much of this as you want, but I also think we've talked about plenty of times on this show where people are lacking ways to interact with others and people are spending more time alone and isolated and lonely. And I think it's okay to judge that too.
I think you're right that we talk a lot in our society right now about not judging people. And we've even made tolerance. I would say we have for the last 25, 30 years, we made tolerance like a primary civic virtue.
Which I think in many cases is okay and probably good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Except that we don't really act that way. We are incredibly judgmental. You go on social media, it's a lot of judgment. There's a lot of shaming. There's a lot of negativity.
And
there's
people judging the judgments of others.
People are judging each other's judgments. And so, like, so my question is, like, why don't we just be clear about what we tolerate and what we don't? Because we say we want to be tolerant, and yet we're expressing judgments all the time, and we're making negative judgments about people, and we're doing a lot of shaming. Like it looks to me like we're a very intolerant society. And as proof of that, I would say in all the years that I've been teaching, which is now close to 40 years, I don't recall ever having a group of students who were so frightened of venturing an opinion on controversial issues in the classroom because they're afraid of their peers' judgments.
Not, though, because they feel guilty about the opinions they have?
They might feel that way, too, but they're just, And they're not concerned about how peers will voice opposition to what they say. They're afraid of like what others will think about what they say. So I think what we've done is we've said like we're going to be tolerant in the way we express ourselves, but we're internally going to be very judgmental about others, and we're always going to be making these judgments. And I think that's the kind of society we've become. And it's a very uncomfortable society to live in because we never know quite where we stand. And the ground is always shifting. That is like the terms of what is socially acceptable are always changing. And this is especially true if you're older and you're not really keeping up on what are all the language conventions and like what is the appropriate choice of words, and so that you're really unsure about like what's acceptable and what's not.
But we've talked on this show, and there's been lots of conversation the past few years about the crisis many young men are facing now, where they're not spending as much time, not in college. And I think your university is like many, you have more female students than male students, where they are finding it harder to date women. They're finding it harder to make friends. They're finding it harder to be out in social situations. I don't have any problem saying that that's bad and that those are all individual decisions that individuals can make about how they choose to live their lives. And unless there's some like overriding mental illness or some other something beyond their control, like I have no problem with saying, you know, staying home all day and avoiding people and watching Netflix or playing video games and making that the most important part of your life is bad. And I think in some ways, and again, it could also overlap something I know you talk a lot about too, is like how gambling plays into all that with sports gambling and other such things. I mean, like all these things are bad. And I just don't think there's anything wrong with like saying that. But I think, you know, some people hear that and say, oh, no, we can't judge people. We can't make them feel guilty about how they're living their lives. I would say no, they should feel like some form of guilt about this because this is not making their lives better. And it's also not making our society better.
Yeah, I think like it's important to feel good appropriately. Like we have a real hard time finding agreement on like, well, what do you mean by appropriate guilt? Well, like appropriate guilt is guilt that diverts you from a true path to flourishing, to a well-lived life. Well, then you have to agree on what a well-lived life is. And if we don't have kind of agreement, like kind of on, the, I would say something like the moral structure of the universe. Mm-hmm. We can't agree on that. Then we can't agree on what is that path that we should be living towards? And so we have what Freud is really interesting on this topic of guilt because what he says is he takes guilt out of the religious context. And what distinguishes a civilized society from a non-civilized society is people have self-control. Like people aren't just slaves. They have some freedom. They have some self-control. But the price of that self-control is this voice inside your head telling you you can't do certain things and then blaming you, making you feel bad when you violate that standard. And this is what we have right now, but the thing is, we don't have agreed upon standards like what are those things that we should do and what we shouldn't do. Like we all have all these disagreements about it, and so people feel bad for all kinds of things.
But you make it sound like, and I think it's true, is that this is very different than say two generations ago, right? And
yeah.
I'm sure there's lots of reasons as to why that might be, but if I were to pick the top reason, it would be something we sort of talked around so far in today's episode, and that's religion.
Yeah.
Is that if that was one thing, and I'm sure I'm more familiar with Christianity than I am others, but I would imagine that almost every religion sort of has these guideposts that say, you know, whether they're as clear as the Ten Commandments, I don't know. But like, say, here are sort of a list of things that are good and not good, and go forth and do just the good things.
Yeah, any religion provides some kind of standard for what constitutes a good life. And within Christianity, like, we have this standard. Well, what is good life? It's a life in which we love God and we love our neighbor, okay? And then we have a name for, like, what does it mean to divert, to go away from that? Well, it's sin, which literally means, like, the Latin term for sin was aversio, to turn away from God, to turn away from one's neighbor. Well, if we're in agreement on what sin is, then we're in agreement on what should we feel guilty about. Well, we should feel guilty when we turn away from God, that is, break God's laws, or we turn away from our neighbor, that is, we do things to harm other people. And so that gives us a standard. It also gives us a way of reconciling. Well, like, how, if I feel guilty because I've harmed my neighbor, what do I do about it? I turn back towards them. That's the process of reconciliation and forgiveness. And so I have a path out of guilt. What happens in a society like today where we don't share, like, a religious conception of the world, where we don't have a shared conception of sin, but we still have an idea of sin, we just don't use the term. We have a sense that some people are acting badly. Some people should be ashamed for what they do or what they say or what they think. But everybody has their own standards of judgment. Well, then, depending on what context you're in, you might start feeling bad because of how other people are thinking about you. But what is the path back? How do you get out of it? Well, you can't, because there's no clear articulation. There's no clear agreement. And even though, like, one person might say, oh, you shouldn't feel bad about thinking that way, you have 10 other people that are saying you should feel bad about it. And I think especially if you're a young person who's trying to, like, figure out who you are within society, that is, figure out what is your social identity, like, you can't, it's an impossible task. That's why we have these really skyrocketing rates of social anxiety, because social anxiety is like living with unpredictability in the presence of other people. And when you don't know what other people's judgments are, like, that's, well, their judgments are unpredictable.
And I hate to, I don't like the framing I made here, because, of course, one of the key differences, I think, between us is that you are a quite religious person. I think that's a fair characterization. Mm-hmm. And I'm a quite secular person, which I would also say that's a fair characterization.
Yeah, I'm not saying you should feel guilty about I do think you're wrong. But this is one of the things, like, I feel quite clear that, mm-hmm, like, this is one of the things about thinking in this way. I have a few very clear ideas about good and bad ways of living one's life. And I would say, I think you're wrong about that. Mm-hmm. Not that you're a bad person.
Yeah.
It doesn't make you a bad person, because you can, but I think you're mistaken about the nature of the world that we are both living in.
And I think what I kind of framed up was that, you know, compared to a couple generations ago, we seem less certain about what we're supposed to feel guilty about. And to me, and I think you agree, is that in much of our society, we've had a deterioration of religion. And because of that, there is not that sort of central or several central ways to look at right and wrong. And although I don't really necessarily like that framing, I think it's probably true. I think you also said too, though, and I'll let you finish, but I think in many cases, especially for people who are more secular, if they don't have religion to sort of give those directional signals, they rely on their oftentimes liberal politics to give those signals, right?
Yes, and I think this is why, like, here's an empirical fact. Children of liberals right now are much less happy than children of conservatives. This has been puzzling for psychologists. Like, why are children of liberals more depressed? I think that it's because there's no clear, there's a whole bunch of things to feel bad about if you're a liberal in today's society, there's all kinds of things that you feel guilty about climate change, about oppression, about colonialism, about all of these things, but there's no pathway towards any kind of reconciliation or forgiveness. Whereas, especially conservatives, many conservatives are members of religious communities who kind of circumscribe the range of things over which one can legitimately feel guilty. Now, that can be bad because they might be wrong about the way they make that limitation. But it also, it means there isn't as much to feel guilty about. And when there is something to feel guilty about, there's a path out of it. Whereas I think the secular liberal in today's society is kind of doomed to always be doom scrolling.
Well, and I was talking to a friend of mine who is way to the left of me, and the context doesn't, I guess, matter much, but we were speaking of a, I guess, podcaster, influencer on the far left, however you want to title him, Hassan Piker, who has taken lots of very left-wing views. And one of them, and this was, he's not a regular contributor to the New York Times opinion page, but he wrote a real controversial column, I think earlier this year sometime, that basically said that depending on the situation, shoplifting isn't that bad. And it wasn't even like the argument of, I'm literally going to starve if I don't get a ham sandwich. I mean, I could almost maybe say, okay, starving or stealing, you know, death or, you know, whatever. But no, this was more like, especially I think the example in New York City, there's a lot of, and in other parts of the country too, Whole Foods is a big store. And of course, that's now owned by Amazon, and Amazon's run by Jeff Bezos. And Jeff Bezos, in many people's eyes, is not a paradigm of values. And I was talking to my far left friend about Hassan Piker and said, you know, I don't know if I'd be like, you know, espousing, you know, his views. He, you know, and brought up his thoughts about shoplifting. And my friend's like, well, you know, Amazon, again, his words, not mine, has been, you know, doing awful things to people and stealing, you know, through wage discrimination and all these awful things and how it's treating people. They've done far more harm than any shoplifter could ever do to them. And I mean, even if that's true, and how do you measure that? But I still don't think like stealing is good. And I'm not religious in a way that I think because it's commandment number 7 or wherever it sits on the tablet. But like, I just think I'm very comfortable living in a society that says stealing from other people or other businesses is a bad thing. And like, I don't feel like that's controversial. And I don't necessarily feel I need like God to tell me that. But it just seems like that's like a basic tenet of society but apparently not my friend and others don't necessarily subscribe to.
First, a little side note on like, and my religious belief and how I would frame that. Like, I don't believe that stealing is wrong just because God tells us that. I think God tells us that because it's wrong. Because it harms people, and it's like empirically demonstrable. And I think like the things that God tells us to do are the things that allow us to have better relationships with other people. And
if I stole from you, you would like me less.
Right. Yeah. And so that's why God tells us not to do it. And I think that's probably pretty good advice.
You were out of the country for a while. I walked past your house several times. Never once did I break in.
Right. And so I don't believe it just because it comes from God. The reason I believe God's word is because in my experience, like God's word is really good advice. And like that's why we should live. So put that aside. There's something really interesting about kind of contemporary liberal culture. And that is the way in which we repeatedly take things that are situations in which somebody might be behaving badly, and we excuse it by claiming victim status because it's the only way left out of this cycle of perpetual guilt. Because if I'm the victim, then I can't be guilty because I'm not the perpetrator. And so what's gone on here with Piker is saying, well, we're all victims of this kind of free market capitalism that's really a mode of exploitation by Jeff Bezos
and the other billionaires.
Yeah. And so that kind of behavior is excusable because we're the victims of this exploitative system. And then, so, yeah, then I don't have to feel guilty about it. I can go ahead, I can do that and not feel guilty. And this is the way out. And I think it is like why you see victim status claimed repeatedly by so many different people. It's not a good way to live one's life because it's not a way forward. Eventually, like if you're gonna have some presence in the world, you want your life to have some kind of presence, some kind of meaning. That is by moving forward and by taking some kind of real initiative, and claiming some victim status is kind of repeatedly stepping back out of the cycle of responsibility. And that's not a good way to live.
I think it was about a year ago this time, we talked a little bit about guilt, but we also talked about shame. And why was that? That was the now forgotten Coldplay concert with the couple that, and for those of you who don't remember, and I can't imagine you've forgotten, but during a Coldplay concert, they do this, they have this camera that was finding random people in the crowd, and it came upon this attractive couple. And as soon as they saw they were on the big screen in front of this concert of tens of thousands of people, they quickly went from an embrace to ducking under and out of the camera's view. And
I just read something about another incident like that.
Oh, okay.
It just happened recently.
And of course, in the Coldplay concert situation, they were not. It was the CEO of a company and his HR director, and I think one of them was married. And anyway, the point being on all that was, did they feel guilt or did they feel shame? And there is a difference. I know we started off talking the show about guilt and we've sort of transitioned into judgment, but I think we'll finish by talking about shame and how that does differ from guilt. And I think in the Coldplay couple, they were ashamed.
Yeah.
But I don't think they felt guilty.
And I have no way of knowing whether they felt guilty.
Sure. But they certainly acted like they were ashamed of being caught.
Yeah. So, yeah, guilt is this internal judgment that one makes, that one has violated some standard or norm. But shame is being seen to be having done something wrong or being seen as blameworthy in somebody else's eyes. And so shame always involves an audience. You can't be ashamed by yourself, by all alone. Now a number of observers have said that we're rapidly moving towards being more of a shame culture, where we used to be a guilt culture because we had these shared standards, and we would know have we transgressed the standards, have we broken the rules.
I mean, it was almost kind of like a joke, right? But people who went to Catholic school said they were in the nuns imparted on them guilt,
right? And shame is this, if we're living in a surveillance culture where we're always being watched and are people are always making judgments about us on the basis of seeing us do something or being a certain way. And so I think that's probably true, that we are moving towards more of a shame culture.
But you don't think that's good?
No,
guilt has the potential to change behavior more often than shame. Is that right?
No, it's not. It's not that, because guilt could change behavior for good or bad reasons, depending on whether one's guilt is well founded.
Yeah,
but when guilt is appropriate, it is related to some real standard of the good, of what is a good life, what we should be doing in order to live a good life. Shame is just what other people think about us and whether they think about us negatively or positively. And if even if a whole bunch of people are wrong, or if I think that people are wrong, I can still feel ashamed when people see me negatively and they're blaming me for something. Like, I can feel shame for something that I don't feel guilty about.
But maybe the final question here is, what should we feel guilty about?
About doing what is wrong.
And that's that simple.
It's that simple, yeah. We shouldn't feel guilty about doing something that isn't wrong. But we might feel ashamed if other people are blaming us for
something.
But
then the question, though, is like, what's wrong?
Yeah, and what's wrong? You know, like, what I think is wrong is breaking God's law and harming, turning away from either God or from people. Like, that is, like, doing things that are harmful to people, that hurt people. There's more to it than that,
yeah.
But that's basically it, right? And this is why, when we don't have a shared conception of what the world is like and how our lives relate to that world, this is what is given to us sometimes by religion, it's very hard for us to agree on, like, that question, like, well, what is wrong? It becomes a rhetorical question. And that's how people ask the question. Well, how do you know what is wrong? Who are you to judge me? That sort of thing. Like, yeah, we don't have any shared standards, so what are you doing passing judgment on me if we don't have shared standards? But then, like, anybody can judge anybody for anything. Well, that's a pretty difficult world to live in, because we never know how people are judging us. And that's a world in which, like, if you don't have a very secure sense of yourself, you're probably going to have some difficulty with anxiety. That's what we're seeing.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. Rick, what is your question for me?
This comes out of a conversation somebody had with me when they were debating over who to vote for. So I'm just going to pose it to you as a dilemma. Let's say you are going to the polls and you are torn between two candidates. The first candidate seems to be a genuine, respectful, sincere person, but you really disagree with some of his policy positions. The second question has a questionable back. Second candidate has a questionable background, and has a record of being really aggressive and disrespectful towards opponents. But you fully agree with their position on issues. Which candidate should you vote for?
Two things that come to mind. This, you said it was a primary election, so if I am voting in this primary election, the way this works is that there is one of these two candidates will go on to the general election. That's how primaries work. And if I sincerely believed that one of these candidates had a better chance to defeat the candidate who was running on the other side, who will, for the sake of this discussion, say I was not a fan of and did not think would be a good for this elected role, I think there is nothing wrong, and maybe there's a lot right, about picking the candidate who is most electable when it comes to the general election, because there are all sorts of small little weird issues that I or other people might care about. But I'm also well aware that, you know, these are sort of niche things that, you know, I'm kind of in the minority on. But, like, the big important issues, I know where I stand and I know which party may support me. So I'm going to want to support the candidate that's most likely to make it through in November. And I know some people think that's the wrong way to look at these things, but I think that would be a large part of my calculus in deciding this. The other thing, too, though, no matter if it's the president of the United States or whether it's somebody on your city council, you want a person that can do two things, or you're looking for two attributes, I think, is one, somebody who has a general agreement on important issues that with you, but also who can get things done and who can even maybe convince others, who can whip votes, who can, and if it's an executive position like a president or a governor or a mayor, to set the agenda and try to gather consensus, not only among other elected leaders, but among their constituents in general. And if one of those people who you describe is disrespectful and unnecessarily aggressive, I would worry that someone with those traits may not be the consensus builder that is needed to get the things done that I think are important. So if both of those things line up against or line up in favor of the same candidate, which I think probably would be the case, it would make my decision pretty easy, even if there were some issues where I may either disagree with on small or medium ways. I think in the totality of the issues I agreed with and felt this person could get those things done, that's what's most important to me. And also, of course, making sure they can get elected.
So you don't have a general, when it comes to, I was trying to draw a distinction between someone who aligns with you on issues versus character. And like if it's character versus issues,
well,
you don't really have a preference.
You lean
more towards issues. Who's going to get the things done that you want?
Yeah. Done? And I mean, if there was somebody who was, I'm just, you know, making up numbers here, but was like 90% in agreement with me on issues, and then there's somebody who's 70% in agreement with me on issues, but I was convinced the 70% person was more likely to A, win the general election, and B, be more skilled at getting many of those things codified into law, I would absolutely support the 70% person. Now, at the same time, if there was a 20% or somebody who I agreed with on 20% or 10% of the issues who was a great consensus builder, and none of that would matter, right? Because I would, you know, think, well, the things that this person is going to try to get done are bad, and I'm not going to support that person's ideas. And I think that also has to be somebody with whom I generally agree with on most issues, but maybe not every issue.
Does that change for the general election? If there's somebody in the general election who you really agree with them on 90% of the issues, but you don't think they're a good person, you don't think they're real honest, you think that they're unnecessarily mm-hmm. aggressive, mm-hmm. and just not nice and not reliable. On the other hand, there's a very good, like a sincere, genuine, basically honest person, but would pursue an agenda that you don't like. What would you vote for in that case?
I would feel like many voters often feel that we have two bad choices. But I would pick the first person there because I feel good policy is much is what really affects people, and I would wish I had a different choice to make. I'm sure that, you know, looking to like taking this out of the abstract and looking at it in real life, you know, they always said for many years, and this calculus has probably changed over the past 10 years, but for a long time, Republicans relied on two issues, especially at the national level, to get elected. And that was people cared greatly about guns and Second Amendment rights, and people cared greatly about anti-abortion policies, and those two policies were generally supported widely by Republicans. I know some people who voted for Donald Trump because they felt like they could never vote for someone who was not on what they considered to be the correct side of those issues. I don't think they believe Donald Trump was a paradigm of ethics and virtues, but those two issues were important to them, and I think that's led to one of the reasons he got elected twice to be our president. So I think there are people who kind of go to the ballot and box and hold their nose and vote for someone whose policies they agree with. And I think the president's a bit of a unique case because he or she, theoretically we might have a female president someday, do sort of set a wider agenda as a, in our country than like any mayor or member of Congress or even governor can. So I think that's probably more important. But like, yeah, if you feel that overturning Roe versus Wade was like your most important issue, and that meant getting certain people on the Supreme Court, and look what happened, and then you must be like relatively happy with that. And so that may not be my position, but I can understand why people would vote for someone who agreed with them on a particular issue, but with which they didn't really respect as a person. I'm guessing you may go a bit the other way.
Yeah, I lean very heavily towards character, but and not too much on the issues. I think the issues are like, I think it does real harm to a democracy when we have people that kind of aren't honest and trustworthy and are, and I'll tell you what brought this. One of the things that brought this up is I keep seeing the word fight being used in people's campaigns on both sides.
So you want somebody to fight for you?
Yeah. I think it's really destructive towards democracy. Democracy is basically like this is how we elect representatives to go and represent us, but represent us in a deliberative process, not in a battle. And I'm thinking it's becoming even more important that character becomes the number one concern, because I think like even if we have the issues winning out that we choose, but we're doing it in a way that makes enemies out of fellow citizens, I think our democracy is ruined.
But I think the reason I would feel maybe differently, though, is, again, we'll take out like small town races where you can actually get to know people, where right. that's different, right? But like if it's like a congressional race, Senate, U.S. Senate race, what have you, you can go onto the candidate's website and likely learn what position points they've taken. And we all know politicians have the ability to change their minds and change their positions. But at least you have a general sense of where they stand. And if they say one year that they support X and then the next year they don't support X, well, you can watch that. If that's an issue you care about, you can see if their actions meet what their positions were. But like those are concrete, and you can see votes they take, you can see bills they sign. But unless you like happen to know somebody running for U.S. Senate, and in many of our states that's kind of unlikely, how do you actually know then that character issue? Because that's a lot tougher to define, and is often defined for voters by negative advertising. This candidate did this awful thing, and you know you don't know how much truth there is to that.
How do you
decide those things then? If it's not positions, which are easy to research, how do you decide who's more morally better?
You look at the candidate's history. Like, what have they done? In and out of politics, yeah. Like, what is their track record? You look at partly, how do they speak about their opponents? Do they speak respectfully about their opponents, about their constituents? How do they talk about their job, how they're going about doing their job? So I think there's a lot we can learn. And I don't pay any attention to negative advertising. If it's advertising that's coming from the opponent or from these PACs. I'd just discard all of that information. But I worry that we don't pay enough attention to it right now.
It was interesting. I was listening to a podcast the other day, and they had on, I'm going to forget her name, so I'm not going to try to come up with it at this moment, but she's done a lot of work with Republican candidates, but and really has a good sense of like how campaigns are run. And how she described campaigns, for good or for bad, as like constellations in the sky. But what she meant by that is, for the average voter, is kind of like looking up into the sky, and you'll see like three or four things that you identify with that candidate. And the example she used many years ago, when George W. Bush ran for his second term as president, faced off against then-Senator John Kerry, and they labeled him a flip-flopper on the thing. And, you know, you can argue if that's true or not true, but that really stuck, right?
Yep.
So you have like this flip-flopper thing, and then you have a couple other like points And then kind of like, you know, how when we look in the sky, we see the belt of Orion or these other, that it just sort of draws in what that candidate is. And once you, and sort of like once you see the Big Dipper, you can't unsee the Big Dipper. Yeah. And I thought that was an interesting way to look at campaigns because, you know, their campaigns' jobs are to define their candidate or their opponent and get people to see these certain spots in the sky.
And that's why the negative campaigning works so well.
Like the flip-flopping.
It's a depiction.
Yeah. But like she said, though, it's like once you say there's the Big Dipper, you always see the Big Dipper.
Yeah, once you saw Mike Dukakis riding in a tank, like you couldn't unsee it.
Yeah.
It was too bad for him.
Yeah. As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And do not, though, expect every podcast to mention Michael Dukakis, but it could come up again. And Rick Kite will write every week about Michael Dukakis between now and the end of the year. Is that right?
I will never mention it again.
I'm just not sure you're dating yourself when you bring up Michael Dukakis. You're going to start
talking
about
that. That was a long time ago.
For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thank you for listening.